fade down. Magos Herrera is playing tomorrow night at the Capitol Theater. Her song album Sina Ilmar from her album Aire. Check it out if you can. I'll let you know you're listening to the end of the Hejira World Music Radio Show. Jeff Spitzer Resnick, your host, here on WORT 89.9 FM in Madison. BBC News coming up next.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. President Biden has told pro-Palestinian demonstrators that they must respect the rule of law. He was speaking in a TV address hours after police in Los Angeles cleared a protest camp at the University of California's LA campus. Tom Bateman reports.
President Biden said people had the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos. He spoke of vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, and forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. His intervention is a sign of how the protests are adding to significant domestic pressure, with the White House already struggling to deal with divisions at home over the war in Gaza. Anti-war protests have now spread to some 50 campus sites in the US. Most have been overwhelmingly peaceful. The pre-dawn police raid at the University of California in LA marks the latest flashpoint. Protesters say police used excessive force and are vowing to continue their rallies.
A senior UN official has said the cost of reconstructing war-ravaged Gaza could be as high as $40 billion. The Assistant Secretary General Abdullah al-Dadari told a news conference the destruction in the territory was unprecedented. Police have raided a network of centres across Europe which were being used to make scam phone calls targeting thousands of victims. The network they uncovered involved criminals in Germany, Albania, Bosnia, Kosovo and also Lebanon. Here's Paul Moss.
They pretended to be relatives in distress. They offered fake investment opportunities. Some of the calls demanded payment for fictitious debts, while others tried to entice victims with promises of romance. The call centres raided by police could phone more than 10,000 people every day. But those behind the scams didn't know they were being monitored. For 4 months, officers were recording calls and then tracking down where they came from. Then, last week, hundreds of officers raided premises in 5 countries simultaneously. 21 people were taken into custody.
Biologists in Indonesia have observed an orangutan treating a wound with leaves from a medicinal plant. It's the first time a wild animal has been seen using a plant with known medicinal properties to heal an injury. More from Georgina Rannard.
This is how it started. Rakus the orangutan crying out before he was injured in what was probably a fight with other males. It left him with a large red wound under his right eye. What happened next amazed researchers in the Gunung Leuser National Park. They saw Rakus chewing the leaves of the medicinal plant Akar Kuning, which has antibacterial properties that local people use to treat malaria. After chomping for 7 minutes, he put some leafy liquid on his injury. Then he chewed the leaves into a paste and applied it onto his wound. 5 days later, the scientists saw the wound had closed up, and within a month, it had healed.
World News from the BBC. The French Parliament has voted in favour of setting up a commission to investigate sexual abuse in the film industry and other cultural sectors. It's the result of a campaign led by the actress Judith Godrèche, who's accused 2 film directors of sexually assaulting her when she was a teenager. The commission will evaluate what enables sexual abuse in the industry, establish responsibility, and recommend future action. For the first time in Kenya, a woman has been appointed as head of the Air Force. The appointment comes as part of a series of military appointments following a helicopter crash that killed the country's defence chief. Will Ross reports.
Major General Fatima Gaiti Ahmed has been in the Kenyan military since 1983, a time when the country had a women's service corps. That limited the potential for women to rise to senior ranks. It was abolished in 1999. Since then, Fatima Gaiti Ahmed has achieved many firsts. She was the first woman in Kenya to become a brigadier, and she also paved the way when reaching the rank of Major General. And now she's head of the Air Force. In interviews, she's spoken with pride about being a role model.
The Olympic Refugee Foundation has announced its team for the Games in Paris later this year. 36 athletes who fled 11 countries will take part in sports including athletics, cycling, weightlifting and judo. The IOC president, Thomas Bach, said they represented the spirit of resilience and excellence. It's the third time a refugee team has taken part in the Olympics. An original watercolour used to illustrate the cover of J.K. Rowling's first Harry Potter book is being put up for auction, where it's expected to sell for around $500,000. The cover art by Thomas Taylor was used in the first edition of the 1997 novel Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Mr. Taylor was only 23 at the time, and it was his first commission. The auction will be held in June at Sotheby's in New York. BBC News.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
Six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places.
And good afternoon and welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. In early March, the New York Times Opinion Division initiated a series on the escalating threats posed by nuclear weapons in our increasingly unstable world. An introduction to the series titled At the Brink began by noting that while, quote, the threat of nuclear war has dangled over humankind for nearly eight decades, the old limited safeguards that kept the Cold War cold are long gone. The intro went on to say, fear of mutual annihilation in the last century spurred governments to work together to create a set of global agreements to lower the risk. Today, that nuclear safety net is threadbare. Joining us today is Bill Hennigan, the lead writer of the At the Brink series. Bill Hennigan writes about U.S. national security concerns, foreign policy, and international conflict. For the Times Opinions section, he's reported from more than two dozen countries on five continents, covering war, the arms trade, and military matters. Welcome, Bill Hennigan, to WORT.
My pleasure, Alan.
At the beginning of At the Brink series, you described the impact of a single tactical nuclear strike on an urban area. I'm wondering if you could give our listeners some brief description, a word sketch of the effects, immediate and after, of such a detonation.
Sure. So I should start this by saying that the reason we did this scenario was because I had reporting from the U.S. government as well as the Ukrainian government about real fears of a tactical nuclear weapon being used in Ukraine in the fall of 2022. And this is when the Ukrainians were clawing back territory from the Russians, and there was fears that Vladimir Putin was going to do something severe in order to stop that push. And the way that this we kind of went about this was, okay, well, the U.S. intelligence estimated it was about a 50-50 chance that this was going to happen, which when I was told this by officials, I nearly fell out of my chair. I mean, we all know the stories of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, you know, President Kennedy put at a chance of 1 in 3 in terms of that turning nuclear. And so, you know, first I wanted to define what a tactical nuclear weapon is, because, you know, these language that we throw around is often arcane and very hard to penetrate. But basically, you know, we know in the 1950s that we've developed the H-bomb and thermonuclear war or thermonuclear weapons, which, you know, are capable of decimating, you know, flattening entire cities, right? Millions of lives. But a tactical nuclear weapon is smaller, and there's no, you know, particular definition, but roughly It's about, you know, the size of a Hiroshima, Nagasaki type of bomb, and or it could be much smaller. And so what I show, or what we talk about in through my words, as well as based on reporting, as well as the graphics department, which really did an immersive job, was talk about how one detonation would trigger this cascading domino effect, that not only would it be limited to the devastation on the ground, you know, which would go for miles and miles. We 10 kilotons was the detonation that we decided on, based on reporting, because I was told that, you know, the fear was that Putin would use something in the single kiloton range, roughly half the size of a Nagasaki type bomb. And the follow-on effects, which would be, you know, fear of food coming out of Ukraine. Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe, you know, all the grain that comes out of there. No one's going to want any of that. It would trigger migration flows. You know, it would stop airlines from flying because, you know, there'd be fear about what the tit for tat, how that would play out between the United States and Russia. All of these things, you know, we think of nuclear weapons as just being big bombs, but they, you know, they would change the world that we live in, you know, in so many different ways.
A line in the introduction keeps coming to mind, that quote, nuclear war is often described as unimaginable. In fact, it's not imagined enough. Talk about the motivation. You know, you touched on it somewhat, but let's get to the heart of the matter of why the Times and the other organizations affiliated with this project thought it important to get it out now.
Well, we really have a confluence of various different things coming together that's made this situation more volatile than at any time during the Cold War. I mean, first of all, there's just more stakeholders, right? There's more nations that have nuclear weapons than the Cold War. There's 9 nations. The other thing is that there's an active war going on, a hot war in Europe, in Ukraine, and you know, Putin has Russian President Putin has, you know, implicitly or explicitly threatened the use of nuclear weapons on multiple occasions. And the other element is the fact that, you know, these guardrails that were established in the Cold War, various different treaties that we had between the Russia and the United States, are no longer exist. They've sunsetted, or they're on the cusp, the break of being eliminated. The last one we have is called New START, which caps the number of weapons that both the Russians and the United States can have. And that is set to sunset in the less than 2 years, in February of 2026. And so, you know, we're in a real new territory when it comes to nuclear weapons, and yet we're having very little discussion about this in our own internal politics, and we're definitely not making any headway diplomatically overseas, where, you know, in China, now the rise of China as well, they're now on their way to build 1,000 weapons, which is, you know, quadruple what they had just 5 years ago.
The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has warned we're closer to the nuclear precipice than we have been ever before. 90 seconds to midnight, to use their terminology. I want you to stay for a moment with the that system of controls that is now, in the word was used, threadbare. Talk to our listeners about what's gone by the wayside.
Yeah. So during the Cold War, we had, we had détente with the Soviet Union, where we were able to establish various agreements, not only on the number of weapons, which were continually reduced since 1972, but we're also the type of weapons and where they can be deployed. We're also was also dealt with. as I said before, you know, these various agreements have all either been completely abandoned by you know, the United States or Russia, or they're on the, you know, or they were sunsetted out where they were not renewed. We have no agreements at all with China. We've never established any arms control agreements with them. And we have, you know, rogue actors like North Korea and Iran, where, you know, Iran is on the threshold of developing a nuclear capability, could go nuclear within, you know, a matter of days now because of the way that they've advanced their program. They've not yet made that political decision, of course, but they have the capability. And North Korea is at a place where, you know, their ability, their capabilities are like the worst nightmare that we had in the 1990s. You know, they have a vast array of missiles and a weapons manufacturing capability that we really don't have very, very good insight into, because it's been closed off to the United States. So, this is all just a combination of a bunch of events that are occurring that to really put us in a very volatile and perilous place. Ellen, I can't hear you. I'm sorry. Are you on mute?
My papers touched up. Can you? I'm back on now. I accidentally muted myself. Sorry, callers and listeners. I was asking what the effect has been of the existence of tactical nuclear weapons on the established system of safeguards. Seems to have undermined the whole architecture.
Right. Yeah, it's a strange capability, because it's not, you know, what held the worst fears of the Cold War, which is, you know, nuclear annihilation at bay, were the theory of mutually assured destruction, of course, right? Where, you know, oh, if you lob your megaton warheads at us, then, you know, you'll get worse than what you were trying to accomplish in return. And so the tactical nuclear weapon is this unique capability where it kind of like muddies that line a little bit, which is they're crossing the nuclear threshold, a taboo that's been in place for 78 years now and has been held, but it's not existential. You know, the world will survive a smaller nuclear detonation. I put smaller in quotes because, you know, even if a nuclear weapon is, let's say, half a kiloton, that is still 50 times larger than our largest conventional weapon. And all tactical nuclear weapons are go beyond any treaty. We've never had a treaty to regulate the number of tactical nuclear weapons that one nation or the other can have. The United States decided after the dissolution of the Soviet Union to rid themselves of basically its entire nuclear tactical nuclear arsenal, with the exception of a couple hundred airdropped bombs that are placed at various bases across Europe for NATO. But Russia has a wild amount of capability when it comes to tactical nuclear weapons, because it plays a large role in their strategy. You may remember that during the Cold War, the United States was at a conventional deficit when it came to warfighting capability. You know, Russia was able to sort of, then the Soviet Union had, you know, more tanks, more arm, you know, more people. They had more stuff, you know, but the United States, you know, being an ocean away and the Allied partners, you know, we had to make up for that gap with our nuclear capability, which is why we had the tactical nuclear weapons, so many then. And now that script is flipped, where Russia doesn't have near the conventional capability that the United States and its partners have with, you know, precision weapons and, you know, cyber strikes and all of these sorts of things. And now Russia's making up for it with their tactical nuclear weapons. So, here again, we have this very concerning threat, and one that you know, the mutually assured destruction doesn't really take into account.
You're listening to Bill Hennigan, who is the lead writer, lead author of this series that's running in the New York Times opinions section, at the brink. We're talking nuclear issues, nuclear destruction, nuclear annihilation. Lots of words.
Not good.
Not good. Not good. You stated in your first piece that there's been a growing concern among those you've spoken to in the national security state and the military establishment regarding the possible use of nuclear weapons. What are some of the key variables that informed their concerns? What were they telling you?
Well, the top line is the current war in Ukraine. And because here again, even in the worst days of the Cold War, we did not have a hot war in Europe. We never wanted to get to that point because, you know, this looming danger of possible nuclear use was imminent. And you know, we didn't have such, you know, forward language, you know, hair-raising type of language by world leaders when it came to nuclear weapons. You know, I'm thinking here of course, President Putin's comments, but, you know, President Trump, you know, fire and fury and these sorts of things. It's the sort of loose language when it came to nuclear weapons is relatively new. I mean, we lived a whole generation without this sort of saber rattling, and now it seems to come back in a big way. And Kim Jong-un as well. I mean, he's threatening nuclear war on a you know, fairly regular basis. So I would say, you know, that the Ukrainian war is at the top of that list. Right underneath that is the lack of diplomacy. You know, here again, we've been able to establish these guardrails and this, you know, this treaty, this lattice work of treaties that has kept everybody, you know, safe. We've kept communication lines open. We've developed the hotlines. These were all lessons learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, these various agreements that held things together, that we were able to have some sort of insight into strategy and the numbers of weapons. We were able to visit their nuclear sites. They were able to visit ours. Here I'm talking about the Soviet Union, later Russia. All of that's done with. We don't have any of that anymore because President Putin has suspended the last remaining agreement, New START. We don't have that sort of that back and forth. And again, we don't have any communication at all with China when it comes to their nuclear arsenal. We see them building ICBM silos in the middle of the desert in northern China. We know that they are you know, increasing the size of their nuclear warhead stockpile by several times, and yet we've never engaged with them in any way about why they're doing this and what they're doing it, you know, what they're going to do with it. So, and as you know, I mean, treaties themselves take years of negotiation and trust. And if you haven't even started a conversation, how can you build trust to work toward this, you know, any effort to try to rein or put a ceiling on the number of weapons that the nations are going to have? So those are the two main factors. I think that there's a third here as well, which is proliferation concerns, long been a concern of the United States. You know, President Kennedy famously said that he believed that there would be, you know, could be as many as 20 nuclear powers in the 1960s. Thankfully, through arms control and international diplomacy, we were able to get through, you know, that number's only 9, which is pretty stunning. But if Iran decides to go nuclear, we know that we'll see other nations in the region, Arab nations in the region, you know, reach for a bomb themselves. And North Korea is not helping very much either with our own allies, with Japan and South Korea, who are worrying about, you know, threats coming from North Korea as well as China about, you know, should they develop their own capability.
You mentioned, you know, you just said if Iran goes nuclear. In a couple places in your articles, you referenced Gaza as a hot spot, but didn't go into it. Certainly, Israel is not going to be too happy with Iran going nuclear.
No, I think that that's a bright red line Israel. I think that they've demonstrated even in recent years their willingness to conduct offensive operations to avoid that from happening. And I'm talking about, you know, the assassination of various Iranian scientists. And I'm talking about, you know, the bombing of the reactors and the sites and cyber operations, which basically, you know, shut down their capability, which is a U.S.-Israeli cyber weapon strike in Iran. So that is very clearly a red line for Israel, and they're not going to move on that.
You're listening again to Bill Hennigan, lead writer for this series, At the Brink, appearing started in early March, and there are forthcoming installments in this series, and people can get that online. I'll have Bill give some information in a bit. Describe what took place in Washington in the immediate aftermath of Russia's February 22 invasion of Ukraine. Tell our listeners about the Tiger Team.
Yeah, so within 4 days of the invasion, the White House, National Security Council, the head of that, his name's Jake Sullivan, he issued a memo that told the NSC that they should create a Tiger Team, which is, you know, a collection of various subject matter experts to, you know, look at an issue and figure out potential solutions. So this is commonplace in the NSC to develop Tiger Teams. But what was unique about this was that it was only involving, you know, nuclear use in Ukraine. Right? It was a very thin slice, very targeted sort of mission. And this is something that, you know, the United States has not had to think seriously about, you know, since the 1980s, really. And, you know, what they found is that they were dusting off materials that were, you know, that dated back years and years before many of these folks were born, in trying to come up with solutions to this. And the idea was they would develop, and they have since developed, a playbook of options for President Biden or any president following him to act upon. So this would be scenario based, like, okay, let's say that Russia uses a tactical nuclear weapon. What are the diplomacy levers that we should pull? What are the military options that we should have? You know, how can we engage other nations to dissuade this from spiraling out of control? These sorts of things. And the Tiger Team, they worked over various months, and they've developed this playbook, which is now in the executive offices, which is next to the West Wing, and it stands there ready to be used. It's continually updated too. It's a living document for President Biden. You know, should the unthinkable occur in Ukraine?
As you said. As you used the word playbook, I thought of the old George Carlin routine about how football has all this warfare imagery, dropping the bomb and so on. So it's been a two-way street. Let's pull out the playbook on what to do in case our opponents pull something with us.
Yeah, this sort of language, I mean, it is in a lot of ways seen as a game, right? I mean, you know, it's a game that all of our lives are at stake, but it is largely seen as a game. And, and I read a lot about the Cold War, and from stories in the Cold War that, you know, it's called like a poker game. You know, these are my cards and those are your cards and I can't see them, but what's the strategy for me to win the hand?
And while all this is going on, of course, the U.S. nuclear capability is undergoing a large-scale modernization program, an overhaul. Talk about that, the revitalization of nuclear weapons complex is already underway and the trillions of dollars that will be invested.
Yeah, I mean, here's another thing that I don't think that American voters are very clued in on. We are spending $2 trillion until 2030. Reinvesting in our nuclear weapons arsenal. And by that I mean the missiles that are buried in the Great Plains states in silos that can be launched at a moment's notice and hit a target on the other side of the earth in 30 minutes or less. The bomber planes, the bomber jets that are that deliver, you know, air strikes from the air, as well as the submarines which lurk under the nation, you know, the world's oceans, ready to strike should the call ever come. But I'm also talking about the warheads themselves, the nuclear, the physics package, as the scientists call them, that go inside of these missiles and bombs. And this is a job, you know, this sort of work has not been taken up since 1991, I believe, the last plutonium pit that was built. We got out of the business of building new nuclear weapons, and we haven't done that in a generation. But all of that is coming back, and we're this work is already underway at Los Alamos, where the birth of the atomic bomb and Oppenheimer and his team established in the 1940s, as well as Savannah River in Georgia. The entire enterprise that goes from across the country is watching as a gusher of money flows through the system to hire new people, to expand their facilities, and to reestablish this the manufacturing capability that we didn't have. And there are all sorts of concerns about this. Of course, the obvious ones are the cost overruns and the programmatic delays that we've seen time after time with multi-billion dollar programs, big ticket programs that the DOD and the Department of Energy sets forward, but also there's safety concerns, quite obviously because of the radioactivity and the materials that are used in these processes. I should just note, the last time that we built plutonium pits was in Rocky Flats, Colorado, and that was raided by the FBI and EPA, and that was the first time in our nation, and only time, I think, in our nation's history, that one government body raided another government unit, and that was because of the contamination that ended up being a toxic waste site there in Colorado. And it was shut down and it has not opened since.
Well, certainly things seem to be going in the opposite direction on so many different levels that it adds to the, it's frightening. Talk about, what's the word I'm looking for? The incapacity, really, to move ahead in a positive direction. How that's impaired by Congress at this point. And
yeah, I would say the first thing is that all of this is occurring. I mean, why this can all occur is that the American voters are not tuned into this in a way that has been prodding their lawmakers to do something about it. And I understand why that is. I mean, we all have too many things to worry about. The, you know, nuclear Armageddon is not something that, you know, you wake up wanting to have to worry about. You know, I'm lucky if I get my kids on the bus on time. So, but I understand that, but that's enabled Congress to be, you know, basically, you know, they're basically rubber stamping all of these programs as they come through. I also feel like there's a lack of knowledge in Congress about nuclear issues. You know, I talk to lawmakers and, you know, there are very few who can talk with fidelity about the nuclear weapons complex and the, you know, concerns overseas. I feel like, you know, we were talking earlier about the treaties, you know, the idea that any treaty could come in front of a Senate and get ratified through is just so remote at this time and place because of the gridlock that we have there. But you know, this is also having a ripple on effect overseas, because other nations see how Congress is treating Ukraine, for instance, and the inability to provide them with weapons. And they're looking at themselves, say, hey, what if Russia tries to do something, you know, tries to invade our country? I'm talking about Poland here. And even Germany to an extent, where they're starting to have these internal conversations about developing their own nuclear weapons outside of having to rely on the United States to come to their to come to their safety, so their defense rather. So Congress's inability to do things is having, you know, I can think about four or five different ways that they're negatively affecting the situation.
You know, that brings us, before I forget, I don't want to put it off any longer, if you want to join this conversation with Bill Hennigan today, give us a call at 608-256-2001. If you have an observation, a question, a comment, give us a call. Now, we can move from Congress to the executive. Your second piece, I believe it was your second piece in the At the Brink series, was titled, "The President's Sole Authority Over Nukes is Dangerous." I found it to be, you know, I think before we went on the air, I said I found this essay on the power of the president to be most disconcerting, most frightening thing in the frightening installment in the series so far. Talk about the chain of command or the lack thereof when it comes to the decision to go nuclear.
Yeah, I don't think many, here again is another example of something that's little known in American, in the way that policy is made. We live in a nuclear monarchy. You know, the president is the only person that has the say-so of whether or not nuclear weapons are used. And he or she, that's a unilateral power. That is not a power. He or she does not have to consult Congress or has to, you know, talk to their advisors or call up the chief of staff at the Pentagon, the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon and talk this through. This is a power that just is sat with the president since, you know, 1945, when Harry Truman made the decision to use to drop the A-bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And you know, that there were efforts at that time in the 1940s and 1950s about, like, okay, this is a new weapon, how are we going to treat this thing? And you know, President Eisenhower came in and he had ideas about maybe delegating that authority, being a former military man, being more reliant upon military officers to make the decision, one that Truman was not willing to do. But in the end, that power rested with the president and it stayed that way. You know, I went to U.S. Strategic Command, which is the head military headquarters that oversees all nuclear forces around the world. And it's in Nebraska, just outside of Omaha. And I was able to see, you know, I was able to talk to General Cotton, Anthony Cotton, who oversees, who's in charge of STRATCOM, and see the tools by which a nuclear strike would occur. I went, you know, four floors below the ground and was in this room where they call it the battle deck. It's underground. It's a Faraday cage, meaning, you know, that it would not allow any electronic interference. It's wrapped in metal so that, you know, there would be no electronic interference underground here. If there was, happened to be a near miss when it came to a nuclear strike in the area. And then there were clocks in the corner of that said, you know, blue impact timer, red impact timer. Time till impact, and all of these clocks would start ticking down if, you know, we launched on an adversary or an adversary launched to us. It was quite a sobering thing to see, and to see the communication lines that would go directly to a president if we're in a crisis like this. You know, they practice for nuclear war every single day, and when you're in a room like that, it kind of slams at home about this is not something, you know, this is not the realm of abstraction when we so often we put nuclear war in. This is a real thing.
I want to get to this another part of the series before we run out of time, and that is the third part, April 15th, your piece entitled "The U.S. Has Received a Rare Invitation from China." In February, the People's Republic of China openly invited the United States and other nuclear powers to negotiate a treaty in which all sides would pledge never to use nuclear weapons first against one another. The U.S. has been pretty much silent on that. The U.S. has never given up on or even offered to give over a first strike capability.
Yeah, even though the United States is the only nation to have ever used nuclear weapons in a conflict, it has retained the ability to launch first again should there be a national security concern that rises to that level. What I said in that essay, my argument was, is that, you know, we should take up China. If China's saying this in good faith, they want to have this conversation, even if the United States is not willing to change its no first use policy, which is largely shaped by our allies' concerns. You know, they fear that if the United States drops their no first use, that this will embolden adversaries in their regions to act against them, that this is some sort of way of degrading the commitment of the United States toward these nations. But even if that's true, even if it's true that the United States was unwilling and unmovable on no first use, the United States should be willing to begin a conversation with the Chinese, because we have so few windows into what they're actually thinking about when it comes to nuclear weapons, that it would be, you know, starting a conversation is just a good idea to maybe, you know, if it isn't even for anything, we can start building personal relationships, which are vital when it comes to, you know, treaty making. And this could result in something years down the line. But at the bottom line is, you know, take them up at what they say, you know, find out what they mean. And by finding out those meanings of what it actually, you know, how, what's a way to verify this, what are your concerns? These are all entrees to other topics that may be more fruitful when it comes to arms control with the Chinese.
Jay tells me that we do have a caller that wants to get in with a question or a comment. Hello, Ron, you're on the air.
Okay, well, thanks for the show, Alan. I would like to let your guests know that back in the 1960s, Peter Watkins made a very telling film called The War Game, and that showed a nuclear attack on England. It was banned in England for 20 years because it was so graphic, and it showed the actual effects of a nuclear strike on English territory, how it affects citizens and how people lost their eyesight looking at the blast and so forth and so on. It's an incredible film, and it was given it won an Oscar and two Society of Film and Television Arts Awards in 1965 and thereafter. So it's called The War Game. It's about 50 minutes long, mainly in black and white, and it's still available on BBC Video. So I hope your listeners will take it up and show it widely, because it's still relevant today. And I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, that's I'll confess, you know, I thought I've seen everything nuclear under the sun, but this particular film is not one that I have seen. But the point, the larger point, is a very good one. We, you know, the people don't understand this as a, being a real thing until they are able to familiarize themselves with the sheer devastation that the, you know, naturally these weapons that are wrought on people. And I feel like, you know, the day after the famous movie, the television movie that was, you know, aired in I believe 1982 or 83, you know, which had millions of people tune into, really shook people, because they could see, you know, we're not talking about arcane subjects and policies or even, you know, the geopolitics of leaders talking. We're talking about the targets of nuclear weapons, which are people, and what that effect is. And so I think that's I appreciate the recommendation, and I will definitely take it up.
We have another caller, as so often is the fact, as we get down toward the end of the hour. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I just want to take exception with something the guy said about Israel's drawing a bright red line. Maybe it's the past 6 months or so that have made me doubt their ability to moderate their behavior. But, you know, targeted assassinations and all those, and accomplishing their goals conventionally is fine, but, you know, things can accelerate, and you never know what can happen. You know, they no one ever thought 40,000 or approaching 40,000 civilians would be something they would do too, and yet they have. And the factor that really bothers me is that our Congress has never shown any ability whatsoever to do anything but fight to prove that they hate whoever Israel hates more than Israel hates them themselves. So I don't see how you could draw the conclusion that bright red line is very bright.
I guess, you know, what I was referring to there is that the red line is that Israel will not allow Iran to develop a nuclear bomb. And that I think it's not very it's not a contentious statement to say that that's like the top of the list, is that if Iran gets a bomb, you know, if Iran gets a bomb, there will be military action. And indeed, we've already seen military action without them even having that capability. I think the current war, I'm not saying that that nuclear war is inevitable as a result of this, that Israel would somehow drop a nuclear bomb on Iran. But I am saying that, you know, just that Tel Aviv is just not willing to allow that to occur. And I do agree that, you know, the statement or the current conflict is kind of dredged up a lot of concerns that we have, not only in the situation in the Middle East, which is, you know, seen as a tinderbox at the moment, but also our own internal politics, because this is a matter that really does not that hasn't been handled with the most care.
We're beginning to get toward the end of the hour. There's a number of explicit and implicit messages to your readers, to the U.S. public, running through the series. Talk about some of those. What are your hopes when you clearly a bunch of people worked on this project? It's an immense thing. Clearly, there's a hope. There's a hope here that it can have some impact on, well, in this election year and after, but on at the macro level, hope in reigniting the deflation, really, of the new arms race.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest thing is that we just want American voters to be aware of the situation and the trajectory that we're on when it comes to nuclear weapons, because it's not good. We would like you know, we're in a presidential year, an election year. We'd like the presidential candidates to engage on this issue and discuss it and make their opinions known about how they see, you know, the nuclear weapons going forward. Because, Alan, just to be frank, I mean, we are handing our children a more dangerous nuclear world than we inherited. And we are also co-signing them, as well as our grandchildren, to another 100 years of nuclear weapons. We're only 78 years in the nuclear era, and, you know, a nuclear weapon hasn't been dropped in 78 years, and that's fantastic, but it does not guarantee the next 78 are assured. And the fact that we are unwilling to engage in this issue the way that it was done in the 1980s, it gives me real fear, particularly because of the lack of information that average Americans and our Congress has about these surrounding these issues. You know, one thing I always say is, when I talk about this, you could walk outside and talk to somebody, bring up global warming, and somebody could give you the broad contours of exactly what climate change looks like and why and all this sorts of thing. If you have the same conversation with somebody about nuclear weapons, they give you an idea about like big bombs and these sorts of things. Or go on a college campus, and here again you have environmental activists and young students that are really mobilized by what's happening to the world when it comes to climate change. But you will not find any nuclear groups, activist groups like we had just a generation ago. This amnesia that swept over not just our country but those of Europe has not bode well, and we're now on a bad tack. And I hope we're able to provide any little bits of information that can kind of send it on a better trajectory.
In the article on China, and you noted that you know, talking election year, that Joe Biden did a shift away from his positions prior to the presidency and so on. Can you talk about that a minute?
I'm sorry, talk about China in what regard?
No, Biden's shift in
terms. Oh, yes. Right, I'm sorry. Right. Well, you know, I will say this about Joe Biden. President Biden is probably the most informed president we've ever had when it comes to nuclear weapons. He was in the Senate during the Cold War. He was he led the Foreign Relations Committee. He, as vice president, led the various initiatives that President Obama set out for the administration when it came to nuclear weapons, which, by the way, he won a Nobel Peace Prize for in his declaration that he'd like to see a world without nuclear weapons. And you know, out of that, you know, President Biden, then Vice President Biden, advocated for America to go to a no first use policy. You know, that this was something that he wrote about. This is all available. You know, don't need to take it from me and people who were in the room with President Biden when he's advocating this for this in the administration, which, as we now know, is never came to fruition. The Obama administration left that policy decision to his successor, which he believed would be, you know, Secretary Hillary Clinton, but ended up being President Trump, and we got a far hard line approach when it came to nuclear weapons. President Biden, you know, when he became president, he was talking about, you know, the fact that we needed this sole purpose of nuclear weapons is to deter other nations from launching on us. And again, he's failed to pull the trigger when it comes to making a policy change involving nuclear weapons. There are people that have left the administration because that they were disappointed about, you know, the trajectory that President Biden was on, and then he abandoned that. But, you know, I will say that the geopolitics, that the tectonics has shifted because of this war in Ukraine. It's now a politically very challenging to make policy changes when it comes to any national security matters.
Talk about how people can get to these articles you've done so far and so on. I know you can't talk about, you must have others in the hopper, but maybe you can give us a hint about what's coming up.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we touched on some of them. One is this three-body problem between, you know, for the whole history of nuclear history, it's been, you know, two. It's been the United States and Russia, which are, you know, provided some sort of semblance of a stability between two powers. But with the introduction of China and the expansion of their arsenal, you now have a three-body problem. And that, you know, how we are able to balance all of that is remains to be seen because it's unprecedented.
Throw into that mix, there's what, six other nuclear weapons powers.
You got it. And you know, when I'll just tease out China, for instance, because, you know, it's this very strange thing in Asia where you have Pakistan, India, and China. Well, Pakistan builds their nuclear arsenal based on India's. India bases their nuclear arsenal on China. And then China bases their nuclear arsenal on the United States and Russia. And so, you know, it's that. You know, the domino effect of what one nation decides to do based on a set of factors that, you know, you can't really anticipate can totally change the way that they're going to proceed with their arsenal. And another story, of course, is Korea and the implications of North Koreans' vast expansion. I mean, they have capability to hit the United States. I don't know if a lot of your listeners know that, but they've developed a solid fuel intercontinental ballistic missile that's road mobile, meaning that it's not at a fixed site where you can watch that site and you can, you know, see the preparations for a launch. It's they're on trucks and they can go drive in the middle of the forest and blast it off without much of a notice, and you know the implications there as well with our allies, particularly Japan and South Korea. So yes, we have various different storylines that we're pursuing, but you can guarantee that we will handle them with the same amount of care that we did for the first set of stories. In terms of our visual representation and really trying to immerse people into the stories themselves beyond my words.
We're almost right at closing time here. But again, if people want to give them the pieces a read, where can they go?
Yeah, you can go to New York Times/ The Brink. And that will bring you to the landing page that will show all of our various stories. Or you can, you know, Google NYT The Brink and find the page there as well.
Well, Bill Hennigan, I want to thank you for the hour. I want to thank you for the work you're doing. The articles have been an eye-opener for me, and I hope lots of people read the ones that are already out and pay attention, you know, especially in this election year. So I want to thank you very much for the hour. I want to thank Jack for engineering. I want to thank Jade for producing. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream. Media are distorted. We come and listen and support it.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Disregard the mainstream. Media are distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded. With information that would never be. Disregard the mainstream. Media. This network's a fraudulent call center. Yeah.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. President Biden has told pro-Palestinian demonstrators they have the right to freedom of speech but not to cause chaos. He was speaking in a TV address hours after police in Los Angeles cleared a protest camp at the University of California's LA campus. Mr. Biden said the rule of law had to be respected by those who oppose the war in Gaza, a conflict that has caused divisions in the United States.
Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest.
Hamas has said it's to send a delegation back to Egypt soon for further Gaza ceasefire talks. The statement added that the group's leader, Ismail Haniyeh, is studying the latest truce proposals in what was described as a positive spirit. An international police operation by Europol has uncovered one of the largest networks of fraudulent call centres across Europe and beyond. The EU's law enforcement agency said officers in six countries raided and shut down 12 call centres in April.